You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Women in Archaeology Podcast, episode 19. On today's episode, we are sharing horror stories from our experiences in the field and how we dealt with them. Today's panel consists of Deidre Black, Emily Long, and Chelsea Slotin. Let's join the conversation.
Everyone, and welcome to the Women in Archaeology Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Deidre Black and Emily Long. Thank you so much for being here today, ladies. It's always good to have you.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Perfect. So today, our episode is entitled Horror Story, How We Survived. And that is horror, H-O-R-R-O-R. For those of you who are wondering.
That'd be a whole other podcast.
Right? Not going there. Anyways, today we're going to be talking about some of the issues that you can encounter in the field and that we have either encountered ourselves or maybe we've heard about somebody else encountering, be they transportation issues, issues in the lab, issues with the personnel that you're working with, environmental issues, it's really hot, it's snowing, it's, I don't know, there's a bear chasing you.
Rattlesnakes.
Yeah, are welcome. So to start that off, like I said, we're going to start with inside issues. And I think, Deidre, you had mentioned a fun tale about sharing lab space with a forensics team.
Yes. Where I did my grad studies, the anthropology graduate department was growing rapidly while I was there. And so for a brief time, archaeology and forensics shared lab space. And it just happened that this particular group of grad students in forensics, the vast majority of them were doing decomp studies.
Of course.
It's fun. It makes great pictures. It smells really bad.
Right. I mean, everyone wants to smell that all the time.
And so this was all going on. And we had one room, and it wasn't so much a room, but there was just some dividers in this big warehouse space. And I was on the other side of this divider counting my rocks, because that was my thesis.
As you do.
And as you do. And the forensics people were actually what we were in what we call the bone room. Because it had an extra sink with a silt trap and all that jazz on it. And there was one archaeologist working there on a human remains collection, like old, dusty, not smelly. But it was also where the forensic students had put their giant navy-sized deep freeze to store the feral pigs that the local ranchers were donating to the program.
Oh.
Oh, no.
Okay. The first problem that we started having was people, even though they were told to wash their bones outside, so that because we had to pay every time to clean, get the trap cleaned. Yeah. And the tissues would sort of clog it.
Oof,
and yeah. So we did have a problem with people washing their bones inside despite being told to. But that wasn't too bad. And then halfway through the summer, mind you, Texas Hill Country summer, 100 plus degrees, warehouse space, it is cooled okay. I am pleased to say that the lab has since moved into a much better place with climate control and all of this stuff for the artifact collections. But not at this time because it was growing. And we're in there, and every now and then we just get this waft of a really bad smell. We're like, what the hell is that? And there was a handful of us, because it was an accelerated program, that we were there, you know, from 5 a.m. till midnight, working in the lab, trying to get our thesis stuff done in very short amounts of time. And at first we thought, well, maybe it's the bathroom, because they're on a sewer lift system, it's not so good. It's an old building. We're like, no, it's not that. You know, a couple more days, the wafting is getting a little more frequent. We go over and I smell the sink, and the sink smells very, very bad.
Oh, no.
And so I put the baking soda and the vinegar in there. I'm like, oh, that's fine. Oh, crap, it's clogged because there's hair in there, whatever. And then, even though that was there, all of a sudden I got a really, really bad waft of the smell, and I heard a noise. I was like, what is that? God. I looked to my left, and I saw that like this giant freezer full of pigs was plugged in, but no one had turned temperature dial, and the sound was the lid releasing pressure and then closing. I was like, what? So I did one of those, you know, quick looks that you do.
Yeah.
Just to see it, to confirm. And like there was liquid, stuff was moving. I shut it and I tried not to throw up. Oh. And I worked at a daycare with small children that were sometimes sick. And I've worked on farms. I've done surveys around chicken farms. But this smell, I don't know because it was concentrated or what, but it was...
It was bad.
Foul. Oh, it was so bad. And then there's all this, like, the department section supervisors getting called and yelling at each other. And one of the forensic students comes in and goes, psh, does it smell that bad?
Oh.
I was like, I am an archaeologist. My bones are not squishy most of the time. And so like, they had to move this whole freezer full of slushing out to the parking lot and get it picked up. That was fun.
Awful. On a, it also involves pigs.
So bad.
But it's not quite a smell story. The forensic field school that I did, because I did start out as a more of a forensic anthropologist than an archaeologist. It was a 4-week field school, and the fourth week I was there, we did mass disaster recovery, which included getting the bomb squad from one of the police departments that was somewhat nearby us. And we had a couple of like FBI people come talk to us. There was someone from the Canadian police who came. So we got a lot of really good instruction, but they took us out into a field, and they obviously had permits and everything. Had gotten some pigs and put them in clothing and in the car and blew up a minivan. And there's two horror stories to this. One of it is scent related, one of it is not. The first problem being that in order to blow this car up, we were using, it was debt cord maybe? I don't know. They were something where you could stand a very, very long way away from the car and hit a button. Before they did that, they said, you know, to the students, do you want to go look at how the pigs are placed and take that into consideration when we're doing the recovery efforts? And one of the girls who was assisting with that class stood about 15 feet away from this car that had live explosives in it and lit a cigarette. You've got like bomb squad people screaming at her and like the rest of us running for cover. And she's just kind of like, oh, but I'm far away from the car. And they're like, not far enough.
It's like miles wouldn't be enough. I mean, it's just, that's bananas.
Yeah. So that was the first part of that like insanity story. And then, you know, it took us 2 or 3 days it was 2.5 days to recover everything. And of course, you know, you flag the car parts and the pig parts and everything. But it was unseasonably warm. So we're in this field doing recovery of exploded pig and car. And, you know, there are tons of flies everywhere and it didn't smell particularly wonderful. And then we also had the fun conversation with the individual from the detonation group who came in and said, basically everything you're wearing, you should throw away because it's basically impossible to get this residue out of your clothing.
The bomb residue?
Yeah. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Like every time he goes through the airport, and they don't, you know, detonate things all that often. Even if it's stuff that he's never worn to work, if he's ever washed it with anything he was wearing to work, he has problems. So there were a whole bunch of us who lost a lot of clothing. So that was an interesting one.
Man, I don't have any stories like that.
Okay, that's the only story I have like that. Everything else is I accidentally deleted the database that had, you know, all of my information in it that I'd been working on for 4 days. Why well, you should I had always a, back things up.
Oh, yeah.
My, I had a coworker do that with field data.
Oh. I actually, one of the government agencies I worked for at one point, they gave me a box of field work, like stuff on notebook paper, random maps, and they said they at one point had an employee where they did a quote-unquote survey, but they didn't actually use Trembles, they didn't really keep track of where they went on the maps, they didn't really do site records, and that it was a complete mess, and they had no idea what happened. And I mean, that's a horror story for sure for the agency, not knowing what happened on the landscape, and did they just throw thousands of dollars down a hole? And so their way of working it out was giving me the box of paperwork and say, reconstruct as much as you possibly can. And I'm going through, and this is one of my first jobs in archaeology, and I'm going through going, they may have gone here, I'm not sure. It's like, they found one flake somewhere in this 5 acres. And trying to go from there. Story in terms of losing paperwork, but for a personal one, in college, while I'm working on my thesis, because where I went, you had to write a thesis, and my computer decided to crash while I'm working on my thesis. I remember it was like the most horrifying experience ever. And I've been backing stuff up on an external hard drive, but I'm watching literally as the computer is shutting itself down. And it's just like, you know, freaking out. And I was trying to like burn stuff on disks and recopy things as fast as I possibly could. And then it was just like, beep. I was like, no! And fortunately, I did not lose anything, but it was the most horrifying experience because I didn't have another computer. It was my senior year. I'm trying to like reconstruct as much as possible. And if it's freaked me out so much ever since then, I am insanely neurotic about backing up information. I have like 2 external hard drives. I have flash drives. I have CDs. And I have the philosophy where it's like, you need to back things up in 3 places, because if you lose one, then you have 2. If you lose another one, you at least have 1 left. It's like, you should always assume you're going to break or lose one of them.
No, that's a great idea.
Yeah. I had lost so much stuff when I was just on floppy disks, that when I did my master's thesis, anytime I finished a page, I would save it to all these different places. And that was when jump drives were like brand new. You know, your half a meg jump drive was $70.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I would save it on my computer. I would save it on the jump drive, and I would email it to myself. Every time I finished a page, I would stop, save, send it to 3 places.
Not taking any chances.
Yeah.
Oh, I was so paranoid. And the fact that I had an accelerated program in particular, like I could not afford to lose, you know, more than an hour.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. And sometimes it doesn't even matter almost how good your data recovery skills are, because I know I've worked with some older collections in labs, and there are a lot of really great things about working with older collections, but older collections often means older collections policies or recovery processes. And if you're looking with something,
is like this state.
Thanks.
Well, it's not even provenience, but I've had collections where instead of, right, today when we bag up items, every item gets its own bag, and you put the site name on it, and you the square number, you know, the lat launch stats, if you have them on there, and you say what it is and what number it is in the artifact log, and you just, all of this information, it goes in a logbook, it goes on a bag, it goes everywhere.
Yeah.
There's so much redundancy, which is wonderful. And I've literally had collections where there's a bag full of objects, and then there's an artifact log that has numbers on it. And then there's some graph paper where somebody's traced the outlines of the objects and numbered them. And then they're all bagged together. And sometimes you can figure out what's what, especially if it's the original paperwork. But sometimes it's scans of scans of scans, and they don't have scales on them. And then you hope that there's something really, 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 really odd-shaped listed on that page that you can find and figure out what the scale is. And it's just, oh, man.
It's bad.
And when you do it, it's great. And you're like, oh, I've accomplished something. This is wonderful. But when that lands in your lap,
you want to hit your head against a wall,
right?
Oh, yeah. A woman I've worked with cord. Has dealt with that with human remains.
Oh, no.
So I actually have two human remains. Where did they come from? Oh. One was someone that was working on their thesis. The thing she was doing for her thesis was pulling together this prehistoric North American human remains collection that had been in a small town museum, and then after NAGPRA was given away, and so she had to figure out how many people were there, where they come from, you know, all the things you would normally do. And the people showed up in wedding dress boxes and burlap sacks and some like vintage grease cans. So like there was one of the grease cans had like all the long bones. There was a burlap sack of random bits.
Oh my gosh.
No. This is why this was a thesis.
Understand.
And she did eventually get it all figured out, but I was like, girl.
I mean, I'm impressed.
That's amazing. The other is it's an ongoing project. A woman I've done a lot of work with, a university that she has done work with on and off, after one of their longtime archaeology professors left and eventually died, they were remodeling the room or something along those lines, and they opened a closet and found a lot of bone. You know, some of them looked really old, some of them not so much. Some had numbers, some didn't. So there was some paper, they were just sort of all jumbled together. And her like personal project she's been working on is figuring out what's going on with all these bones. And she's found out through some very old records from the early days of the State Historical Society that this guy would be notified when a cave of prehistoric remains would be found. And he supposedly maybe excavated a couple or not. We don't know. And some of them are maybe teaching bones. And so she's currently, this is her personal long-term project, trying to figure out where all these bones came from. Do any of them need to be repatriated? If so, to who, to where? Just this giant jumble of people in a closet that no one knew about. Yeah. And the guy that knew about it is dead.
Of course. When, even if it's not human, I've had some osteology professors who, for teaching taphonomy portion of their class, whenever they have fried chicken or whenever they have T-bone steak or whenever they have ham or turkey at a holiday. And I don't think these people have dogs. they'll throw the bones out in their yard and periodically dig it up and give it to their students as a project to figure out like, which bones have been out there longer, or which bones were in the dry soil versus the wet soil versus, hey, I threw some in a bonfire one summer. And it's a really great project. And if you're just talking about the bones that came out of your, fried chicken, it's fairly certain legal. Like, I think you can, you know, do whatever you want with those bones. Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine if that, like, just finding that somewhere and not labeling it. Like,
like, what are all these ham bones doing here?
Right?
I'm very glad that I wasn't the person that had to move that lab, because over the years at the old lab where I did my project, people would pick up roadkill, especially snakes.
Especially what?
Put them in paper bags and put them in the freezer. They would pick up roadkill.
Oh, God.
squished animals.
Yeah.
But mostly snakes. And put them in a paper bag and label them, and they were stacked up in the freezer right next to my lunches. Right. And some of the original people that were keeping them there have long since left the state. I think there was some plans for some of them that didn't happen and some that did. I'm just very glad I'm not the person that had to figure it out. Oh, look, it's a freezer of snakes. Awesome.
So it seems like we're having a really excellent, come on guys, record keeping, it's important, yes, kind of episode.
Paperwork, yeah, is a good thing. Paper
and,
trail.
And dump is a horrible smell.
Oh man, yeah. It's
almost as if we're repulsed by it for a reason. And decomp indoors is worse.
No, decomp is terrible. I have a fun decomp fact that's not about humans, and then we're going to be at the end of our section. But when sharks decompose, apparently they release some sort of, whether it's like a neurotoxin or a regular toxin or what exactly it is, but it's basically a warning system to other sharks so that they don't go into those areas. So areas that have a lot of either illegal or legal, I will admit I don't know a whole lot about shark trading, but that catch sharks to take their fins off and then the rest of the shark back in the water, and obviously it doesn't have fins, so it doesn't last very long, which is all very sad, but when those animals pile up, there will be no sharks in that part of the ocean. Because it's a warning.
And then they're not eating the predators that eat the smaller fish, and so you get a big explosion in the mid level predators.
Yeah.
And all the smaller fish that people, the small time fish for their family or their village, all get taken away.
Right. It could also be contributing to shark attacks in coastal regions because sharks are trying to get away from the toxins that indicate death. So anyways, on that completely non-archaeologically related
next time
fun
on Discovery
of the day, right? Thank you, Shark Week. we are going to step away, and when we come back, we will be talking about personnel issues.
Hooray!
Encounter.
Professional Certifications for Scientists, or PCS, aims to provide practical educational videos, field guides, knowledge tests, professional certifications, and employment connections to professional scientists everywhere. Check out the resources page for useful links, a directory of CRM archaeology firms in the U.S., and a link list to state site forms. Find PCS resources at www.pcscourses.com/resources. PCS, a place for good scientists to become great science professionals.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Women in Archaeology podcast. Before the break, we were discussing some of the inside issues that can arise during archaeology. For the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to be discussing some of the personnel issues that can sometimes occur in archaeology. I think that there are a multitude of opportunities for that to happen, considering how closely we work with one another and how long we spend together without civilization sometimes.
Oh, definitely. And I think we've said it on some of the other episodes that one person can really make or break a project. And that's why you always hope for the best group possible and relatively easygoing personalities, because one person can just bring an entire project down so quickly.
Yeah.
And you just hope that one person isn't one of the supervisors.
Exactly.
Yes.
And you'll definitely get conflicts because, I mean, if you have multiple, let's say you have a large-scale excavation, you'll have multiple supervisors, multiple assistants, and there will be clashing heads. And I know I've experienced that myself, and it can be incredibly frustrating where you think there's one way something should be done, and you think the way other people are doing it is completely, you know, impractical and nonsensical. You just kind of have to go with it because you're not in charge.
Clearly, Emily, you should just always be in charge.
Well, obviously.
Well, and there's sometimes people will disagree, and especially if it's a gentleman of a certain caliber and the supervisors that they disagree with are women, you get some very, they're more likely to voice this opinion.
Yes.
And not as a question. So sometimes if I think it's something that my supervisor would be doing, you know, it could be done an easier way, I was like, hey, why are we doing it this way? You know, most of the times I've done it this way. You know, open-ended. I want to learn, you know, we never stop learning. Mm-hmm. But then I've had the guy go, well, if I was the supervisor, I wouldn't be calling it for rain. This is stupid. In front of the client, might I ask?
That's unprofessional.
I was like, well, but I have more experience in this region, and I know that it's going to rain really hard, stop for half an hour, and then rain so hard the trucks won't get out. So we're just going to go.
Right. Common sense for the win. Yeah.
Well, and especially stuff where safety is involved, it's always good to speak up. Like, you may be in a terrible situation and you feel like you can't do anything about it. It's always better to speak up. I mean, I've been in situations where we're working outside and I'll have one person who's really good about making sure we all run to the truck if there's lightning. Well, then there'll be another situation where the person in charge is not that way and they'll have us keep working even though there is lightning strikes, you know. That you can see.
Yeah.
And oh, no. And that type of thing. And I mean, in terms of advising.
If you are worried about your safety, get to a car.
Exactly. And so, I mean, in terms of our horror stories and how we survived them, I mean, personally for me, the surviving part is just take care of yourself and make sure you're taking care of everybody else. I mean, if it means having to step on the toes of your supervisor or something, sometimes you just have to say, no, this is ridiculous. I'm going to the car and I'm taking these people with me.
Right. But also,
I've had to tell my supervisors, I know that that is how you want this to go and you can do it that way, but I will sign out as supervisor because I don't want to risk my RPA standing and my antiquities permit standing by doing that.
Good for you.
I know, I still have a job. I was surprised.
I've been pretty lucky that I haven't dealt with many major personnel issues or huge personality conflicts. The big ones, unfortunately, though, were pretty big. I mean, I can, like, count on one hand just, like, you know, just a couple. But, man, were they rough. And right, the point in the field where I was just like, you make me want to quit type of thing. And so for me, that's the worst somebody can make you feel is that you want to quit your job. And this ties into our ongoing conversations about sexual harassment in the field. And just as a personal experience, I unfortunately had one encounter where I had one person, and man, it's just one person, consistently telling me how I was doing thing was, and I quote, retarded, stupid. If this is how the other people taught you how to do this, they're being stupid and ridiculous. You're wrong. And they would call me little girl and just made me feel awkward and bad. And just, it was awful. And I mean, it went for days. And At one point I did have to call our personnel person and say, like, this, I cannot do this anymore. And this is, I cannot do it. And so the way for me for surviving was just getting out of the situation and just saying, I am done. I'm putting my foot down. If I have to work with this individual again, I quit. And sometimes you just have to do that. And it sucks. And that experience is awful. But you just...
You have to take care of you.
Exactly.
Right.
If that makes sense.
I've been the mid-level supervisor. Mm-hmm. That had to deal with the person no one wants to be on a crew with. Ooh. And I'll relate things to, you know, to the person who actually has power to hire and fire. No one wants to work with this guy. He makes everyone uncomfortable. He's really sexist. Da, 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 da. And it took 3 field outings before I finally accumulated enough safety concerns regarding this person, and that there was people that refused to come work those projects if he was there before he finally got on the no-call list. Mm-hmm. And being the mid-level supervisor in those sucks, because you get all of the blame and none of the power.
Yeah.
Because you're the person that the crew sees as doing stuff. You're the person that the big boss, you know, communicates through. And you're just like, I have no power.
It sucks that it took that much
Well, and I think maybe if this person wasn't of their age and gender, that it wouldn't have taken that much.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't a young person. It was a middle-aged man. And I think if someone was causing that much problems and they weren't someone that our society ascribes so much automatic position to, it wouldn't have been as bad.
Right.
Well, and it's frustrating when, I mean, you have multiple examples of that person acting unprofessionally and inappropriately towards everyone, but when you bring in sexual harassment, I feel like it should be a one chance type thing. Like, you do it once, you're out type of thing. I mean, there shouldn't be second chances.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing. Because I honestly don't think talking to these types of individuals will do any good.
No, well,
nope.
You also get, unfortunately, a lot of times as soon as your complaint of inappropriate behavior becomes sexual in nature, there seems to be, I've seen, and not everywhere, some people are really good about this, but kind of a societal generalization. As soon as you say something about sexual harassment, people kind of seem to step back a little bit and maybe put a little less stock in what you're saying. And, you know, it's horrendous, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you're just being sensitive. It's like, no, I'm insulted and uncomfortable.
Right. But it's hard to deal with, and there are a lot of issues, and people, I mean, how many, rape is one of the most underreported crimes, and how many women who report it, you know, have questions asked of them, or what are they wearing, or how much had they had to drink, or, you know, had they ever hooked up with the person before? You know, there's so much doubt around it, and that doubt around even this most serious of crime trickles down and kind of infects anything of a sexual harassment nature.
Well, I have two non-sexual harassments dealing with personnel in the field. Mm-hmm. One is illness.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of CRM projects, they're quick, get in, get out. You're out there. There's our two vehicles. And if you don't do field work, you don't get paid.
Yeah.
So people will work very, very ill. I was on one project where I was a tech, and it was cold. We were in the lee of the mountain. We were in a rundown motel, as per usual. And everyone just kept getting sick. We never had a whole crew after the first week. It was several months long where we were working 8 on, 6 off.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were working 10-hour days. Yeah, after that first week, there was a flu that was going around, a stomach bug that was going around.
Oh, a stomach bug. And so you would just worst.
And stomach bugs will literally go through a crew just over and over again. Because by the time it gets to the end of the crew, it's mutated. It's like an elementary school. Right?
Well, so if you think about it, individual, a crew is just a petri dish.
Yes, it is. You're, you know, slammed together in this tiny car or truck. And one of the worst things that happened was one of the crew chiefs, a man, in the middle of the night one night, during all these illnesses, started passing kidney stones. And you could hear him throughout the entire motel. I knocked on the door of the girl that was in the room next to him. I was like, what's going on? She's like, he's passing stones. If he doesn't stop within an hour, we are going to drag him to the hospital. And in fact, we did drag him to the hospital.
Oh, good.
He ended up getting admitted. He ended up getting admitted because they were marbles. They weren't going to pass. But he had been up screaming, keeping everyone up, passing these kidney stones.
And that sucks. I mean, it's like, it's terrible that he's going through that, but at some point, you got to realize, it's like, you can't harm the rest of the crew. You know, it's like, do yourself a favor, get to the hospital, don't infect the rest of the crew, don't keep the rest of the crew awake, don't,
And because he was a crew chief, that means, like, his whole crew couldn't go out.
Oh, man.
It sucked. And then we had one gentleman that ended up, the flu hit him really hard, he got pneumonia, and he ended up being in the hospital for almost 3 months. That was really bad. And it was his first, CRM job. No. He hadn't even had a field school yet.
Just in terms of, you reminded me of one where just keeping people awake in general, which can be the worst thing on the planet on a CRM project. So you're like, I must sleep. I need to eat and I need to sleep. You mess with any of those things, you're going to have a grumpy crew. There's like no amount of like candy that's going to fix that. And we got, I was on a project and it was, we were on this project for like a month and a half. So we only got one day off, 1 day per week. So that night, you know, right before our 1 day off where you could, you know, enjoy it and relax and all this stuff, one of the guys almost blew up the hotel. And so what had happened, instead of, you know, like a logical human being would think, I can't put, you know, gas-powered stoves in a hotel room and, you know, and then fall asleep while cooking something. They could, you know, catch on fire and potentially explode. And what had happened, this guy fell asleep and the stuff, it was burning and caught on fire. Somebody had walked by his room and noticed all the smoke pouring out, and they tried to wake them up. They had chucked the stove into the sink and tried to get that figured out, but it was just like smoke was billowing out of the bedroom. Somebody was yelling, and this was like 2 o'clock in the morning. Somebody was running down the hallway yelling fire, and then the alarms were going off, and it was like snowing outside, so we all had to like get out of bed in our pajamas, put on coats, and then we couldn't get back into the hotel for a while, and then the hotel smelled like smoke and weird burnt chicken. We were so pissed off because it's like, you ruined the one time we can sleep in. Everyone was so pissed off. And it was just, yeah, we got through it, but man, it was just like, that ruined the week. Because it's like, you ruined our 1 day off. It's like, don't be that guy.
Speaking of blowing up hotels, I was on a very long project with multiple locations, multiple crews, you know, hundreds of archaeologists in little five-person crews. And I got to one, and I saw this huge divot in the parking lot right next to one of the rooms. It's like, what happened here? Well, the crew had decided they were going to fry a turkey. They were in that part of the world. They were going to fry a turkey. And I am from the world that fries turkeys. I have fried many turkeys. But there are a number of safety steps you're supposed to follow. The one that they were not aware of, well, actually two. One, you need to figure out the displacement before you heat up the oil. The other is you do not put in a frozen bird. So not only it exploded, overflowed, caught on fire, and melted the asphalt. And the hotel still didn't kick us out.
Oh my God.
I know, we were with the guy who almost blew up the hotel, because if the canister had caught on, blew up, you know, the propane tank, it would have been bad. But yeah, we didn't get kicked out. That blew my mind. So yeah, that's awesome. Your crew didn't get kicked out either. It's like, thank you.
It's like, you melted the parking lot.
It's like, sorry. I didn't mean to.
Sorry. My people are gross. Sorry.
I can't say I've ever been somewhere that almost blew things up. I've been pretty lucky on the sleep situation. There was one up in Canada, doing coastal archaeology on a boat. and we'd gone into a town to, you know, pick up fuel and water, and our captain was great, and he often woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning to start the day because, you know, it's the middle of summer and it's subarctic and it's light 20 hours. So, but there was one night in particular where we had stopped in this town. It's called Cartwright. Mm-hmm. And you would think subarctic, how bad could the bugs be? Ooh. The answer is bad. Very, very bad.
Aren't there like clouds of mosquitoes and
yes,
flies?
And black flies and horse flies. And this particular problem was pretty much just the mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And just opening, you know, we had the boat pretty well sealed off, but opening the door in and out to, you know, hook up the water tanks to get fresh water and to get gas, which someone has to leave the boat to do. Bugs would come in, and while we were all eating dinner, we're all sitting there, like, clapping the air around us.
Oh, no.
Trying to squash these mosquitoes and hitting the walls, and we must have killed 200 mosquitoes just at dinner. And, you know, after dinner, we're still, like, trying to kill various different mosquitoes and this, that, and the other thing. And they're still there, and they're still being god-awful. And we all tried to go to sleep that night. There were enough mosquitoes that you could, like, hear them buzzing, and you could, like, feel them when they landed on your face. Because we're all in sleeping bags and, you know, nice berths that are a whole bunch of 2x4s put together, so real hard. It was so great for my back, actually. Loved sleeping on those things. Not everyone felt the same way. Mm. But, you know, and it was just warm enough that you couldn't really, like, stick your head inside of your sleeping bag and then try and, like, pull the sleeping bag down over your head. But then if you're like me, you start doing the, like, what if I suffocate? I'm claustrophobic. I'm not actually. But when you're completely engulfed and it's warm and it was just terrible. And, like, I ended up leaving and going and trying to sleep up on the mid part of the ship that was still enclosed, hoping that it was going to be better. And it was a little bit, you know, but then our captain was up 2 a.m. starting the engines, and, you know, we started moving, and we had, you know, got to wherever it was we were going by 7, 8 a.m. So we all had breakfast real quick and then went and did archaeology. And it was a rough day. It was a rough day.
I will say I was really proud of the interpersonal relationships of my last field crew, because we were in a very tick-heavy area. Mm-hmm. And you could be wearing a spacesuit, it would have gotten in. And mm-hmm. everyone had a buddy, and they would look at each other's everything. Ticks off.
Oh, man.
And everyone, like, it was good. I was really proud knowing. everyone found a buddy. Oh,
man. You know what else is terrifying other than ticks?
Yeah.
Sharks.
So terrifying.
They are so terrifying.
Well, you know, you're more likely to get shot by a toddler or killed by a falling vending machine than attacked by a shark.
Well, that makes me feel better.
Yes way.
Excellent. And on that wonderful shark fact, we're going to end our second segment. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the environmental issues.
So more bugs.
Impact. Yeah. Bugs, bears, heat, colds. It's all open.
So many bugs.
Oh, bugs.
I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm the host of the Heritage Voices podcast. Heritage Voices focuses on how CRM and heritage professionals, public employees, tribes, and descendant communities can best work together to protect their heritage through tribal consultation, collaborative ethnography, and indigenous archaeology. Now back to the show.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Women in Archaeology podcast. When we left, we were talking about some of the
personnel issues that you can run into in the field. Moving on, in this section, we're going to be talking about some more environmental issues that can crop up. But someone mentioned a conspiracy theory coworker over the break. Yes. And I know I want to hear that story. So.
And
go. Well, we are moving into the outdoors, and it involves the outdoors. So there we are.
Perfect.
You know, we work very closely with each other, and I had a crew member once who was really into chemtrails and other such things. I was talking about how I really needed to get to the dentist, that I had a couple of molars that were cracked from me grinding my teeth, and I wish I had grown up somewhere with fluoride in the water, grew up on well water. And he starts going into, oh, fluoride is mind control. It's put out by the aluminum industry as a way to get rid of their runoff, which is partly true, but it's still good for your teeth. And then he starts going into chemtrails and going on and on and on. Every time we would see a plane fly by, and we were on a major intercity flyby with planes up. And if they happened to have, you know, chemtrails because the moisture was high that day, he's like, look at that. Look at that. It's just the government, you know, engineering our weather. It's like, dude, shut up. And I would try and steer the conversation elsewhere because I try really hard to get along with my crews. And I would talk to the guy and chemtrails, engineering our weather. It's like, oh my God. And there was other things. That's just the one that stuck out, was the chemtrails, because I talked about them multiple times a day. And one time I just, can we not talk about chemtrails? Let's just keep it to archaeology and our job, the dirt, the chemtrails, the chemicals fall in the dirt. There are enough bad things on this dirt. I've done surveys in cotton fields in Mississippi.
Ooh.
And there's a crust of chemicals on the top. That's why I learned to not put the dirt in my mouth to figure out the texture. Ugh. I was like, ooh, this would be a bad idea.
Yeah.
I mean, there are honest to goodness horrible things on the dirt, but it's not chemtrails.
It wasn't the government.
Outdoors working. It was that crazy crop duster. In that area, we were told that crop dusters, once they started the job, had a 10-year life expectancy.
You're kidding.
Because they flew so low to the ground, and there's a major trucking route right in the middle of their flight path. But that didn't stop them from trying to chase us through the cotton fields. And we're like, I'm going to die. If it hits your lungs, they start to bleed.
Oh, my God.
There's a desiccant for cotton. And luckily, it's not sprayed by the planes, but by a giant tractor with these real long arms.
Mm-hmm.
And if you breathe in enough of it, your alveoli spontaneously bust open and start bleeding.
That's terrifying.
That's when a bunch of old fat archaeologists figure out just how fast they can run. The only other time I've had to run out was weather related.
So note to self, never survey in a cotton field.
Yeah, that's really what I'm hearing.
It was unpleasant. I couldn't see my feet.
Ooh, I hate when you can't see your feet. That drives me nuts. Cornfields, that kind of thing. Sorghum. I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a completely not archaeology, but related to cornfield story.
Oh, yeah?
Oh.
My grandparents grew up or lived on a farm, so whenever we went out to visit them, we were always told not to go play in the cornfields, and we always did. And when I was like, I don't know, 8 or 9 probably, we were out playing in the cornfields one day, and I ran across a black widow.
Ooh.
That was ginormous. I'm not sure you could pay me enough to do archaeology in a cornfield. After that.
Well, speaking of fun environmental things that are trying to kill you, there's certainly, I mean, enough animals, insects, weather patterns, I mean, all the above that we certainly encounter on a daily basis. And some days they're certainly worse than others. I'm personally a horrible klutz, and I have small feet. And so I'm prone to trip anyway. Like, there've been multiple times where we're serving and then just my coworkers will see my feet up in the air and they're like, "What just happened?" And I'm like, "I fell. I'm okay." But in one area, my feet are small enough they'll fall in rabbit holes. That, I mean, they're not super tight. They're like, we're size 6. But at the same time, those rabbit holes were really big in this area and you couldn't see them. And so I kept just falling into rabbit hole after rabbit hole. And I had a screen on my backpack.
Can I make an Alice in Wonderland joke?
I know. It's like, I was like falling down the rabbit hole. And progressively it got worse. And at one point I sprained my ankle. And so we're starting to hobble back to the car and we're trying to get over an electric fence. And so we're using the shovel to push it down and try to, you know, not get electrocuted. And my foot catches because I'm already off kilter because of my ankle. I've got this big screen on my backpack. And so I completely flip over the electric fence and hit it. So I get shocked. I flipped. I've got a sprained ankle. Then it was also incredibly hot and incredibly humid. So really dehydrated, super hot. And I was just like, I think Oklahoma's trying to kill me.
Oh, fences.
I know. It was just like fences, rabbit holes. Just it was.
I've seen some coworkers get caught up in the fence. This is never a good thing.
No,
I was surveying out in the West with a gentleman who was very tall, and he did not like to go over the fences or through the fences. He preferred to sort of get on his back and push himself under the fence.
Oh.
To each their own.
Sure.
I prefer to go over, because I've gotten too many spines in the butt.
Mm-hmm. And but we were in this one. In fact, you might be rubbing yourself along some grass full of ticks.
And so he's halfway under, his head and his shoulders are under the fence, but it's like his arms aren't, and he gets stuck.
Oh, man.
Like, big man in a little coat, stuck. Around this time, the bull that's supervising the herd of cows on the other side of the fence goes, "Hey, what's going on over there? What's all that ruckus?" And so we see this bull kind of mosey over. And I was like, "Dude, there's a bull." Which I probably shouldn't have said, because then he started like flailing.
Oh, no.
And which made the bull freak out. And the bull is like moving one step closer, just snorting and on the ground. Like, "Oh shit, I want to watch this guy get killed. I don't know what to do when he's moving his legs. I can't grab his legs and pull him away." And luckily for him, right at the last moment, I guess the rancher had figured out something was going on and drove his little pickup truck full of feed going honk, 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 honk. And the bull's like, "Ooh, snacks." And finally my coworker calmed down enough. I pulled his feet out. I was like, "So we're going over the next one?" He's like, "Yeah, we're going over the next one."
That's terrifying.
I've never been the most athletic person, but weather and animals have made me figure out I can run hurdles if I need to.
Oh my gosh.
Especially when the sky is green and you're in between the power lines and a mobile home park.
Oh, jeez.
That'd do it.
It's an indicator of a tornado, right?
Correct. Especially when you start hearing the train sounds. Like, no. Jeez. There's nowhere to go. We just dropped our stuff and ran hurdles over the barbed wire fences to the nearest, like, building. Mm-hmm.
So I've never had any issues with tornadoes, luckily. Knock on some wood. And I can't say I've ever had issues with bulls. But we have. There was a day that we were out. Again, boat, because coastal archaeology. And, you know, a bunch of us were on shore digging, and the captain was still out on the boat. You know, and the horn on the boat starts going. And we're like, "Oh, what's going on? Maybe we should go check on the captain," right?
And we get back out to the boat, and apparently there was a bear that we hadn't been able to see from where we were that was just kind of stalking us.
Oh my gosh.
And like none of us had a gun. So if someone would care to email in and tell me what the appropriate response is for how to deal with a black bear without a gun, without dying, I'd really greatly appreciate it.
A black bear or a grizzly bear?
There's a black bear, I think.
Because black bears, you can really just make a whole bunch of noise and they'll just run off. They tend to be more
fun. And make yourself, yeah, make yourself big with your jacket.
Yeah, whereas grizzlies... And if
you're in a group...
Yeah. I knew I was talking to the right people.
But with grizzlies, that's a whole other thing. They have bear spray. You should carry a rifle. You should not run away. I mean, with grizzlies, there's not a whole ton, much, a lot you can do. If they're going to attack you, they're going to attack you. And that's why a gun or bear spray is probably the best option. So it really depends the bear. Because I've dealt with a lot of bears in California. And they're just like your basic black bear, brown bear. And they'll walk right by you and just be like, hey, what's up? You know? Or if you scare them, you just want to get in between a mama and her cubs, and then otherwise you're fine.
Right.
And you don't want to startle them.
Exactly. So like when I was on the trail by myself a lot, coming around corners or into like a new area or down a hill, I would clap a few times, or I would just make a lot of noise as I'm walking just to be like, look, I'm not a predator. I'm okay. I'm not here to eat you, and just making a lot of noise. You'll be fine with that type of thing.
It's a great time to practice your freestyle rap skills.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Make the next Hamilton.
Well, actually, Lin-Manuel Miranda got over his fear of freestyle rapping by him and his college friends driving to and from Vegas from Connecticut in a week, and he had the overnight driving shift.
Oh, I think we're gonna say he got over his fear by doing archaeology and rapping to himself.
No, but it's a great way to keep your mouth moving and keep your mind moving. Stay awake.
Oh, yeah. The next major rap musical, Trailblazers.
I'd listen to it.
It was a bear.
It's a bear.
And then there was a bear. Most of the bears I've dealt with are the little black roly-poly ones from the eastern forests and the swamps. And they're not too bad. You just don't startle them.
For bugs, because I want to jump on the bug train that you guys were talking about with ticks and with mosquitoes. Well, out here, we get the June bug season, and Juny gnats, June bugs, they're awful. They're not the cute little June bugs or something. It's like literally gnats that bite, and so Juny gnat season, and it's off. And they're juniper. That's what I was trying to get at. Juniper gnats. They're super tiny. You can wear a gnat net. You can wear a mosquito net. They will find a way to crawl through them. And they swarm and they love to bite your ears and scalp. And they leave these welts. And so it's like they get gross. And they just, it's like a couple weeks during the summer. And you just never know when it's going to happen. But if you're around juniper trees and in the high desert, you're going to get swarmed. And there have been a couple of times where I've been in an area with horrendous juniper gnats. There's no wind. And it's super hot. So you can't even stop long enough to, you know, take notes or trying to do site paperwork. You have to keep walking, and they're biting your hands. They're biting your ears. Your ears are inflamed red, even though you're wearing a net. You can douse yourself in bug spray. It's not going to do anything. I've been told that people carry around lit cigarettes and have taken up smoking just because of the juniper gnats. and they're just the worst. I mean, I hate ticks, I hate mosquitoes, but there's something about those juniper gnats that it's just you can see them on your gnat net and you can watch them crawling through, and you're just like, no, don't come near.
Be gone with you.
Exactly. It's awful, and they'll get in your ears. And I just
up your nose.
Oh yeah, it stinks. And like, you can't stop for lunch. You have to keep walking. And of course, it was a day where we had like tons of sites to record. You're just like, oh,
always
the one time I don't want sites to record. But yeah, the best things people said, sometimes eucalyptus worked relatively well, some of the more natural bug sprays. But it, essentially, I mean, it just sounds like they will bite through anything. Some people were making almost a paste out of really thick sunblock and bug spray. And what is that?
Bullfrog.
It's a really stinky bug spray. It's like Skin So Soft or something like that.
I mean, there's like Off Deep Woods.
No, it doesn't work. But there's like, there's some bug spray that's called like Skin So Soft, and it has a really pungent, like weird flower smell. And they would mix that together in with the sunscreen and like make a paste. And it's just, oh, it's so bad. Don't come to the Southwest during that time.
For similar bugs, I had a lot of people in a swamp area, and they did not want to use DEET. I understand.
Sometimes you just need it.
You just got to use a DEET. So they were using all these things that they were using as old wives. So some people were diluting Listerine and spraying that on them. Like, that doesn't do anything.
I've never heard.
And finally, they were trying everything except the DEET. And I'm like, you know what works really well? DEET. You know why? DEET. There's also the one that starts with the, yeah, there's the one that starts with the P that you put on your clothes.
What is that?
Fight.
I don't know. Although
if you're looking, other stuff,
if you're
looking good. Me. And so they were using Repel has a fairly decent one that's eucalyptus and a few other things mixed together, and it will keep the bugs off for maybe an hour or two, as opposed to DEET, which is 8 to 10 hours. Mm-hmm. But we found out that it attracts love bugs. Now, keeping in mind, there's two types of love bugs. There's the love bug that bites you and hurts really bad. This is not that type of love bug. The other love bug that I'm talking about, they just sort of hang out in swarms, and the male and female bond together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and they fly around as one critter.
Oh, weird.
And they don't do anything. They'll cover the front of your car, but they don't bite you. They don't really land on you. They're just annoying. And they're not, they're about the size of a pinky fingernail. You know, they're not really big, they're not really small. They don't really get up in your nose or anything. They're just sort of hanging out. But they loved that Repel eucalyptus natural stuff. And so someone would have some in their back pocket, and their behind would just get swarmed with these things. That's pretty funny.
Ugh.
And then as you were talking about smoking, when I did my field school in Belize way back in 1998, there are several people that only smoked when they were in Belize. Because the mosquitoes there can carry botfly.
Oh, I hate
botfly.
I was one of, I think, 3 people that didn't get one out of 50 people in my old school.
They sound and so just hanging disgusting.
Around. And we're just hanging around. You're like, oh, there's a little maggot in my arm. Well, I mean, we had monkeys throwing poop at us. Someone ran into a jaguar. Scorpions, really tiny ones. A vampire bat got stuck in the bunkhouse one night.
Aww.
So that was lots of bugs. If you're going deep in the bush, expect lots of bugs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and after a week, it's completely normal to open the outhouse, lift up the lid, kill the scorpions, put down the lid, do your business, kill some more scorpions, and keep going.
We're a hardy bunch.
Yeah. But yeah, just as a quick word of advice for the listeners, I mean, if you're going into an area with a lot of bugs, like Deidre said, use the DEET. And then the chemical we couldn't think of, and I've used it on clothing before going into areas with really bad bugs, is permethrin. And like DEET, it's not a good chemical for you. It's not healthy. But if you're going into an area where your choices are get Lyme disease versus not getting it, use the DEET. And then permethrin, you can spray it on your clothing ahead of time, and then it can make your gear, like your backpack, your tent, completely repellent.
Right. Yeah. And just a quick word for the permethrin, do not get it on your skin, because it is a neurological reagent. And there's plenty of videos on YouTube, someone spraying permethrin on their skin, and you'll just have a foaming at the mouth seizure. This is not a good thing.
Yeah, you gotta be super careful with all those kinds of chemicals.
Yeah, for sure. So I think, ladies, we're just about at the end of the episode, but do we have any kind of final thoughts on dealing with problems that can arise in the field? I think we need another shark fact.
I think we can always do another shark fact, but in terms of closing thoughts, I think, I mean, the best takeaway from this episode is that, I mean, yes, you can deal with a lot of crazy things in the field, from bugs to bears to even people. People can be horrible, but we survive.
And monkeys.
And we keep doing what we do. You just kind of keep on trekking and then take good advice, think what needs to be done, use DEET, take care of yourself, and everybody's going to have horror stories. There's no way to get around them. You're gonna, I don't know, get ticks, you're gonna fall down a switchback, you're gonna get stuck on a barbed wire fence if you're doing field work. Something's bound to happen, but we keep on keeping on. They're survivable.
Yeah. Right, and we also might love the work we do.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yep. And you know, whatever you can say, your job's not boring.
That's true, you have good stories.
Just like, I have a friend, and he's done a lot of underwater archaeology, inland and in the ocean, and you never know if you're going to turn around the corner because you're looking in a reservoir that used to be a town, and you look inside a building, and you see a big mouth, and it takes you a full minute to remind yourself that sharks don't live in this lake. Well, bull sharks can go upstream, and so you can get bull sharks as far north as Illinois, and the sharks in Lake Titicaca are bull sharks.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can change the direction of their kidneys, so they can exist in salt or fresh water.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Sharks are amazing.
That's why they're still alive.
That's really what we've learned this episode. You can deal with a lot. Stand up for yourself if you have to. DEET is a very, very useful substance, even if it's not the best for you. And we should all know more about sharks.
And look out for the land shark.
Right?
The land shark.
So, thank you so much for joining me today, ladies. It's always wonderful.
You're very welcome.
And we'll see you around next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope you have enjoyed the show. Please be sure to subscribe and rate our show wherever you listen. We are available on iTunes, Stitcher, and probably whatever your favorite podcasting app is. Remember to like and share. If you have questions or comments, you can post them in the comments section for the show at the Women in Archaeology page on the Archaeology Podcasting Network site, or email them to us at womeninarchaeologypodcast@gmail.com. This show is part of the Archaeology Podcasting Network and is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle. You can reach them at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Music for this show was Retro Future by Kevin McLeod, available at Incomptep and royalty-free music. Thanks for listening.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.